Oi. Hey, good evening. Can you hear me? All right. So, fewer people actually talk about death. You all ran away. Okay. So, we still have a few more minutes. Any questions from last week? Any comments from last week? Class? It's about death, in case you don't remember. So, death is mentioned previously that it usually is a taboo subject in most societies. Most people don't really want to talk about death. But surprisingly, when in the past, when ran courses, a Buddhist courses on the topic of death, usually death is the most popular. And so there's certain topics that people like, whether they are Buddhist or not, and one of them is on death. Because I think although it's kind of a frightening subject, it's also one that we probably are curious about, interested to know about death. The ideas that maybe sometimes the practices or the things to do or not to do related to death, and so it becomes so it's sort of popular. And personally, I find that after being a Buddhist for so many years, it's one of those first topics that you learn, after you become Buddhist. And definitely, I personally have found it very beneficial. To have studied the different teachings related to death. Not that I meditate on them, but sort of in the audience that it is the imprint consolation. Remember I mentioned about how you cannot remember anything, but then you console yourself, oh, there will be imprints. There'll be some impressions on the deeper level of my mind or brain or whatever. Even if you fall asleep. And I think that has some effect because when I do encounter death among those that are closest to me, then I find that my reaction to that, is more modulated. Although we still, I will still experience loss, grief, and so on and so forth. But the fact that I've been bombarded so often with the notion of death. And about all the things around death, the process of dying, what to do, what not to do, and la di da. And just by, this whole idea that you're definitely going to die, you don't know when you're going to die, And only the Dharma, which we're going to cover today, only the Dharma, the spiritual practice that you have cultivated in life will be most helpful at the very time, moment of dying. So all this, ideas that's been repeated over and over again, I find them very helpful to come in handy when I myself have to face the death of those closest to me. It's almost like, I think the process is, we can say, a process of normalization, normalize the fact of death. Death is as intrinsic to life as birth. The fact that there's birth automatically means there will be death. The two sides of the same coin. And but so often in our society, in our culture, we celebrate birth, right? We celebrate birth, we celebrate 1 week after birth, 1 month after birth, 1 year after birth, and then we celebrate all our birthdays, right? But then very rare do we take into consideration while we are alive. The fact of death, which is the other side of the coin, which is just as relevant and just as important. In fact, sometimes even more important. And through studying Buddhism and through being exposed to different ideas related to death. That kind of a good preparation for death. Yeah. Doesn't mean that you wouldn't come across as frightening or unpleasant, but it's almost like in the mind, a place is set aside for the reality of death, just by the fact of being so exposed to this idea, this notion over the years. And that has been very helpful, at least for myself, I think. And I think for a lot of people, it really helped them to cope with losses, the losses of dear ones, and help them to find means to deal with the grief that arises, and also to carry on with their lives. Yeah. Though most of us will naturally be able to do it after a period of time. But I think having a certain kind of framework and kind of understanding really make that process a lot easier, a lot less unpleasant, and a lot less painful. So there are great benefits to becoming aware of that while we are still alive. So last week I covered out of the what we call a 9-point meditation on death. I covered 6 of them. They come under 2 main categories. The first 3 come under the main category of reflecting on the certainty of death, certainty of our own death, as well as the death of those around us. That once we're born, then the other end of it would be death. Right? And this is presented in terms of 3 points. One is that no one, or there's no way to escape from death, right? If you think of an escape in terms of location, there's no place we can go to where we do not have to experience physical death, right? And there's no means, at least no means now, that's available for us, you know, so that we don't have to die. Even freezing your brain, that, which is what some people did. Either you freeze your brain, or if you have more money, you freeze the entire body. Cryogenic something cost a lot of money, but that only happened after your death. You don't want to go into a deep freeze when you're still alive, isn't it? Yeah. So that, even that doesn't avoid that. Maybe you know, like I was joking last week about, if you practice some Taoist, means to become immortal. Yeah. I don't know how successful you are, but you can try. Apart from that, death is unavoidable. That's the first point. Second point is that even while we are alive, continuously our lifespan is decreasing constantly with the passing of each second, each minute, hour, each day. And we are moving closer and closer to our so-called final destination. And the idea is that, and there's no slowing it down. It's not like, oh, tomorrow, public holiday, right? So let's stop the clock, no? Tomorrow doesn't count because we are on holiday. Doesn't work that way, right? Tibetan image is like the nomads. They travel, or especially those who travel on pilgrimage from wherever they are traveling towards Lhasa, the capital, usually to pay homage at the Dzogchen temple, the holy image. So of course you travel during the day, and then you camp, you pitch a tent somewhere along the way for the night, right? So there is so there's resting. You know, you rest, you stop traveling, right, when you're on the journey. And so that is true for a physical journey. Unfortunately, for our journey was that even while we are asleep, even while we are stationary, we are still moving closer to our own death. So that gives a sense of urgency, a sense that we are constantly moving closer towards our final destination. And the last of the 3 points is that, and even while we are alive, if we reflect, the amount of time and energy we devote to preparing for death, especially preparing for death in terms of cultivating a spiritual practice, cultivating a Dharma practice, is very, very little time we spend, very little energy, relatively speaking. So let's say if you meditate an hour a day, or half an hour a day, you devote half an hour a day, and half an hour of 24 hours, the day is a very small percentage, right? And then, of course, then we also take holiday from a Dharma practice. too tired. Maybe another day. Or we try to, blah, 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 blah. I wouldn't call it Dharma practice, but we sort of recite at some neck-breaking speed. I used to be able to do it. Oh, okay, finished. By the way, yeah. It sounds like a very low standard Dharma practice, spiritual practice. Practice with the mouth, because the brain is already half asleep. Yeah. I used to get, recite my prayers in a half asleep state. I just go, one prayer go round and round. For the whole hour, I never move forward, because I was really half gone, right? Like, it's so painful. This way of practicing. Yeah, so the actual fact, the amount of time we devote while we are alive and well and healthy to our spiritual practice, to cultivating virtuous qualities, to prepare for that, it's really very minimal. Right? And so, doesn't sound very good. Okay? Doesn't sound very well. Nice from our point of view, how well prepared we are to face our own death. And so that's the first 3 points, the certainty of our death. The next 3 points are said to be much harder. We can understand it, it's just common sense, but to really let the importance of it, the impact of it to affect us is much harder. We have a much stronger resistance to letting in the next 3 points, which is related to the uncertainty of the time of our death. We really don't know when we're going to die. Of course, we do everything we can so that we don't have to die. Yeah, but the reality is when death occurs, it can be very sudden. It can be like split second. It doesn't come with a notification. In an hour's time, you'll be dead. There's no such notification. Right? So it can be very sudden, and can, of course, we find it very shocking. We find those type of death is the most difficult to reconcile, because we didn't prepare for it. We didn't have time to say goodbye. We didn't have time to set our affairs in order. But the reality is, the actual time of our death is very uncertain, it's unpredictable. And there are 3 points that I mentioned. And the teaching, first is that our lifespan is not fixed. But nowadays we have statistics that say life expectancy is increasing. Usually the ladies are like maybe 87, and the guys tend to die younger, like 81, right? Okay, but those are statistics. The statistics that is applied to the whole population of people. Okay, just on the average. But individually, we still die at different age. We die when we're young, we die when we are not so young, not so old. No. We die at any time, at any age. So there is no fixed lifespan that we can be assured that I will definitely live for so long. And during this time, no matter what happens, I will not die. There's no such assurance. And the second thing is the causes that contribute to our death are many, are very varied, very many, are all over the place. And the causes that actually sustain our lives are much fewer. And there are occasions where even the causes or conditions that are supposed to support life become those that take away our life, not the causes of death. The causes that support life are food and water and drink. Medicine, shelter, no. There are occasions where the shelter becomes the cause of our death. Medicine can cause death. And even food and drink can also be the cause of death. Yeah. So there are many, I think the idea of, some of these points are not to make us paranoid, okay? But just to highlight to us that really, death and our own death, the time of death is really very uncertain. Do not be too complacent about it. The last point is, our body is actually very fragile. We always talk about this story that I think it happened in a real story about how, I think in the early days in the 70s, you know, when the hippies, they travel in Nepal and India, they like to walk around by the locals, barefoot, you know, just walk around. Unfortunately, if you didn't grow up walking on barefoot, because you develop calluses, you become much tougher. So what happens is there are people who get, maybe they step on something like a nail or a thorn, and then they didn't look after the wound properly, and which gets infected, you know, and then lead to a generalized infection, and then you die from it. Die from just like a prick of a nail or a thorn that is not well treated. You know. And so just like that, you say, the body, although can be very resilient and can be very remarkable in recovering and healing, sometimes things can fail very dramatically from very tiny little causes. Yeah. So these 3 points add up together to try to heighten the sense that we really don't know when we will die, the time of our death. So it's no good saying that there will always be tomorrow. tomorrow, and then a day will arrive when there is no tomorrow. This is it. This is the last day of my life. Yeah. So I mentioned at the beginning of last week's class that the whole idea of talking about death and meditating on death is not to stir up the fear of death. Because we already have the fear of death, right? That is almost instinctive. So the whole idea of reflecting on death is not to scare us, right? Get us so frightened that we will behave ourselves. That's not the whole point. The whole point, in fact, fear can interfere with dealing appropriately with this whole notion of death. So, of course, occasionally fear can arise. Fear can arise even as we go about our own business, you know, when something might trigger the fear. So the fear is not the aim of the reflection, the meditation, but the fact is to get us to start to think seriously about the reality of our own death, and to get us to prepare for it. And this goes nicely with the previous topic we talked about, appreciating our precious human life, where we learn to recognize how wonderful our life is, how wonderful and how unique or special it is, and also to recognize what we can accomplish with it. And so that allows us to be more appreciative of our life, have a very positive regard to and a wish and wanting to make full use of our life. And the topic of death that comes after that makes it even more important for us to really make good use of the time we have, and not to waste it, and to cherish what we have with us right in this moment, the opportunity that our life offers to us, and it's open to us to decide what we want to do with it. But we must seize that opportunity. We must recognize the potential within our own life to want to do something about it. Because if we don't want to do anything about it, then what happens is we just follow our old habits. I used to work in aged care, and you find how powerful old habits is, that we just go day by day following those old habits. And then the day comes when you get a bit too sick, or you lose certain mobility, and then that's it. Some of those old habits, you can no longer do them because you are not mobile enough. And then you just do nothing. You just sit there literally waiting to die. Right? And that seems such a waste. Of course, each one of us has, you know, we are free to choose what we want to do, but there are a lot more possibilities. Yeah. And it's really up to us to go for them, to recognize and to take a more proactive role, you know, to seize those opportunities and make full use of it. And from the Buddhist teaching, the Dharma point of view, this life is a wonderful opportunity. Right up to the moment of dying, there is something you can do about it. You can do something while you are awake, you can do something while you are drifting to sleep, you can do something during sleep, and you can do something while you are dreaming, and even when you are dying, there is some practice you can do. How remarkable is this? Very busy, right? Busy life. So, even dying, you can do something. You know, the fact that you say, I'm dying, is no excuse for saying, oh, then you don't have to practice. This is it. No, no. It's all the more important to practice when you're dying, and all the more important to make use of our life while we are well and healthy. Right? So that is the whole idea of reflecting and becoming aware of the fact of death. Okay, so that's what we have covered previously. Any questions? Any comments? Must be crystal clear. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think you need to reconcile. In a way, if life is suffering, then death, which is the end of that life, is relatively speaking, is a relief, isn't it? So it's to put an end to it. Whether we will be suicidal or not, that varies from individual cases. But a lot of people really, I mean, they are not suicidal, but they are waiting to die. You know, they I live long enough. I've done all the things I want to do. I'm just waiting for that to happen. And that is really, really up to the individual, how we see our life and our death. I think, personally, from the Buddhist perspective, of course, even in very difficult situations, if you learn about the Dharma gives you more possibilities, open up more possibilities. In the face of great suffering, there are actually many things we can still do about that. So that is the valuable thing about Dharma, about the Buddha's teaching. If you know about it, you learn about it, and you are aware of it, it opens up so many more doors of possibilities. But for someone who is not inclined in that sense, not spiritually or religiously inclined, and they don't have that understanding, or they don't have that faith, then of course they rely on whatever that is available to them. Right? And maybe within that, whatever resources they have for them, this is the best they can do. They can do. They have exhausted all the things they can, and for them, death is the final relief, or release from a life of pain and suffering and hopelessness. So of course, the way we do, if we are in a position, if you are in a position to share our Dharma knowledge, then we can of course, offer an alternative. But from the point of view of the Buddha's teaching, there are too many things we can do to transform our pain and suffering. But that's the best we can do. We can share if they are open to listen, and to offer another way of looking at it, another perspective, as I say. But whether the person is open to take that in, to even listen, or to even change their mind, that is really very much up to them, and up to the condition. Which is why it's good to hear about this early on, when you're not in great pain, you're not in great suffering, when you have not somehow depleted your inner resources to deal with it. Having even planted the seeds of possibilities makes a lot of difference, and also gives you a lot more choices when you are faced with those difficult situations. You say, oh, what is wonderful time to practice this meditation called Tong Leng, which is you breathe in, oh, suffer, now I just breathe in. Take on the suffering, not just yourself, of all sentient beings, and then you breathe out and you share whatever happiness, good fortune you have. And of course, you need to practice it, but when you do that practice long enough, it has this remarkable ability to change your perspective, that even very difficult situations can be transformed into something very positive and very, something almost you can transform a suffering situation into an opportunity to practice the Dharma. But for that to be true, we need to learn and practice beforehand. Usually, when quite often when I teach meditation class, people come when they are already depressed in the grip of serious clinical depression. That is a very suffering state. Yeah. But when we are in deep suffering, there is also very limited resources available for us to learn new things, to try out new things. Because it's so much of our energy and attention is all entangled with the suffering. I mean, of course, we can try, we all try our best. Yeah. But ideally, before we are in that state, if we learn something different, we make available, we practice some spiritual practices, then that becomes very valuable when we are in the midst of suffering, in the midst of a depression episode. We can call forth those knowledge and those practices and understanding, and they become a support for us. They become a refuge for us. Right? So that's why when we are well and happy and healthy, that is the time we cultivate our spiritual practice and understanding, we expand it, and we build our resilience, we build our support, so that we can rely on that time of need, or the time of, let's say, time of dying. When we are dying, it's not a time to learn new tricks, right? Like, okay, here I come, let me teach you a new mantra. Okay, that's when you dig into your resources, whatever you have, you pull out, this is a true story of one of the early Western translator of Buddhism, Geoffrey Hopkins, is quite famous. He translated quite a few important works from the early days when there were very little Dharma available, especially in the West, in English. And he suffered at one point from Lyme disease, which is transmitted by ticks. Yeah? And Lyme disease, there are different forms. This one is particularly serious, like it sort of shut down his entire system, including his consciousness, his mind. And he found himself undergoing, at one point, the death process, the dying process. He's basically he's dying, right? How the consciousness starts to disintegrate. Next week we'll talk about this. And he recognized, because he translated it from Tibetan into English and published a whole book on this death process. And while that process is happening, basically a lot of your conscious control is already going. So it's not the time where you think, I wonder what my Lama taught me about this. I remember it was inside that notebook, the red color one, the third shelf. No, I don't remember what's inside it, but I remember the notebook. That's not the time where you can consciously recollect. You very much depends on what you have already familiarized and what comes out up to help you. And what came up for him as a mantra that his teacher has taught him. Just out of nowhere, there's something connect and the mantra appear in his mind and his mind starts to recite. It's like, it just come on, the tape recorder or now MP3, and the mantra and the attention goes to the mantra. And by reciting that mantra, his dying process stopped. It's like early. And then you notice that it's all going back in reverse, coming back to life, and he survived that particular incident. And then he's on the mend, he recovered from that Lyme disease, which is a serious side effect, in the sense that even when he sort of recovered, he had some brain damage, he messed up his brain. I think he's still alive, the scholar, right? But he has some problem with reading, he can sort of recognize the writing, but he cannot connect with the meaning or something like that. There's some damage to his brain function, and it took him quite a while to sort of reconnect them back. It takes a lot of effort, yeah. So, that's a good example of how your practice while you are alive, comes to support you during the dying process, a process which is essentially a loss of conscious control. All this ruminating and, this is the time to do this and do that, all those things are disintegrating and disappearing. And what you come to rely on are what you are most familiar with for your life. And they arise out of deep within from your unconscious to support you. It doesn't always take dying for that to happen. Sometimes in a dream, you're running around, you're chased, you're in great fear, don't know what you're afraid of. Before you're happily, comfortably in bed, the next moment in a dream, something frightening is happening. Some people, while that happens, the Dharma practice comes to them. I have a friend who does this, recite the name of Amitabha Nyenpo. She's the one that on the bus, you recite, right? It makes the practice become very ingrained. And even in the dream, a frightening dream, a nightmare, where you're all caught up in it, then automatically the practice comes to you. And then your mind settles. And then, so it helps become a support for you. So the whole idea of thinking about that and become aware of it, and then practicing and living your life in the awareness of death, is precisely that when the actual death occurs, you will be well prepared. You won't be frightened. Not only will you have lived a life, a meaningful life, a life according to what is important to you, but you will also have the courage and the resources to face the actual dying process. So today, just to complete the 9-point meditation, the last 3 points is related to the topic on the question, what is important, what is most helpful or most important to me while I'm dying, during the dying process, when this life is coming to an end. Okay. But different people, and of course from the Buddhist perspective, then we say, oh, the only thing that's the most important, most helpful, while you're lying there, or wherever posture you are in, and you're actually dying, is your Dharma practice. It's your cultivation of the spiritual practice, or different spiritual qualities. That's the one that is most helpful to support you. And the 3 point is to reflect on what about other things that we might value while we are alive. How helpful are they at the point of dying? Material possessions, which is what we spend most of our life, our energy, our time on, the alarm from the universe. it is. I'm surprised. Okay. It should be, I thought I switched off the. Oh, I see. Okay. Material possessions that are very helpful. Don't give up your material possessions. Right? You must think carefully, okay? There are people who give up and say, oh, I'm going to live in a cave. I find that a cave is pretty unpleasant to live in. It's a bit hard to get back your material possessions. You've already given up, right? So you should think carefully about this, right? Before you try to be renounced. You must make sure you're really that renounced before you renounce, okay? Otherwise, it might be a big mistake. But nonetheless, what is very important while we are alive, the physical material possessions, are not very helpful at the time of death, the time of dying. As you say, how many beds can you may have? I don't know how many bedrooms you may have. Hope each bedroom has a bed, yeah. But no matter how many you have, at the point of dying, you can only be lying on one bed. Right? Big bed, small one, you just have, usually it's the hospital bed. So, from that point of view, I mean, this is very relative. I'm just talking about relatively speaking, okay? At the point of dying, what is really important may not be the amount or the actual material possession. So that, in certain settings, having many material possessions means instead of focusing on what is important at dying, you worry about what's going to happen to my material possession. Who is going to have it? No, this person must not have. I'll come back from my grave to make sure that this one, this my precious possession, will not go to this person. Sometimes we are that attached to it. So the whole idea is to think that at the point of dying, what we probably spend the most time and energy, effort while we are alive, gathering, etc., accumulating, not going to be the one that supportive of us, most helpful for us at the time of dying. Okay, so that is from the Buddhist perspective. So it's important for you to reflect and think about it. Okay, now a lot of people say, well, it's very important to have material possession while you're dying. You get to stay in a nicer hospital room, right? And more services and good services and attention. Maybe not, right? Because I was told in a private hospital, I was told that there are even fewer nurses, because nurses in short supply are very expensive, right? So you can be staying in a private hospital, pay a lot more money, and there's no nurse, you know? The entire floor has no nurse, no matter how you press. Having material possession or money doesn't necessarily always translate to goods and services at the point of dying. Go to a public hospital. It's better. subsidize also. Can save more money, leave it for other people after you're dead. So that's the first thing to think about. I think it's important to think about it relative to yourself. Don't always do it. It may be stated in the teaching this way, but you must think about it in relation to your own experience. Okay? The second thing is relationship or loved ones. Loved ones are not very helpful at the point of dying. Why? They can hold your hand. They can be with you. Unfortunately, dying one of those processes in life. It's like going to sleep like that. No matter how many people you have around you, it's something you only experience on your own. It's a very alone experience. The actual dying process. Oh, sure, of course, it's very important to have a supportive community of people around you to support you as you go on that journey. But the actual dying process has to be experienced on our own. Just like sleeping, you're the experience on your own. It's worse when you're surrounded by a lot of people and they're all asleep, right? And then you say, you're the only one that cannot sleep. That's the worst. What's wrong with me? Which is, that's why I rely on drugs. I rely, usually I cannot sleep when I was traveling, right? But I do have motion sickness. So I choose the motion sickness drug that is with drowsiness, the one that you take, you knock off for 8 hours. Wonderful. And then the pharmacist was saying, "Would you want something natural?" I said, "No, I don't want anything natural. 100% artificial. The chemical, no, the one that is." And also, I'm a research chemist. A chemist by training. I want the synthetic one. No, the one that I take and then knock me out. That's it. Because I'm not so much asleep, but motion sickness is quite very unpleasant, especially when you're traveling. Those who are driving in India and then you have this road that is like, it really stirs things up. So it's really good to just knock out under the influence of drugs. You arrive there. Oh, is it? We arrive? Very good. Nice journey. And sometimes when you're awake, it's even more dangerous. I remember that was before I had my motion sickness, before I rely on drugs. This Indian bus, which seems like lots of holes. Yeah, I just see the road. I was driving, and this is a real one. When the brake doesn't work, it didn't work. But this bus is traveling really far around the van. So in the end, it has to go off the road to get more friction to stop. Imagine that. And Tara's mantra comes to me on Tara's territory. This is it. Bike, death. Well, this is for real. But then next to me is this person, my friend. Sleep. Totally oblivious. Blissfully oblivious to life-threatening situation. Then when the bus stopped, what happened? Life can be so ironical sometimes, right? So, the second point, sorry, I'm just sort of getting a bit carried away. At the time of dying, the process itself has to be experienced alone. So, even people that we love and care about us, they cannot come on that journey with us. Even if they are also dying, they will have that. You know those romantic stories on Chinese soap opera, right? Or I'll die with you. Fine. If you, no problem. But the actual experience is lonesome. And we have to rely on our inner strength and inner resources. Okay. The third point is that our body, quite helpful, not our body. Our body is the one that of course throughout our life we look after it, we try to keep it healthy, and dying unfortunately is when the body is saying goodbye to you. The body is shutting down, the body is failing us. I mean it failed us during the whole dying process, but definitely at the moment of death, the body is the one that is saying goodbye, is shutting down. So our body will not be able to help us. So the whole idea of this 3 points, that our material possessions will not be helpful at the time of dying. Our loved ones, our relationships will not be helpful. And also our own body, our very own body that we cherish, that we rely on our entire life, it is not going to be helpful at the point of dying or death. So the whole idea is to highlight what is important, very helpful at the point of dying is actually our Dharma practice. Not our Dharma knowledge, but knowledge helps, but the actual practice that we have cultivated in our life. While we are alive, while we are well, we are healthy, we have energy, we have strength, that's the time we need to devote some of those time and energy to cultivating our inner resources, our inner strength, resilience, the things that will come up to support us automatically. This is where it's not so much about consciously thinking, but about what we have so integrated and internalized that they come up to support us. And also, you don't need to wait for dying to evaluate. There is a practice, I think they do it in this center, a fasting practice called Nyunae, the Nyunae fasting retreat, where you fast. The retreat is about 2 days, a little bit more on the third morning. But you fast for slightly more than 24 hours. Right? The fasting is you cannot eat, no salt, nothing. Basically, don't eat. You cannot drink. This is actually the hardest. Right? No liquid, no water at all. No drinking, no eating. And a blessing is you cannot talk. All right? Talking wastes a lot of energy and you will complain. Like nothing like that.
What's going on? I'm dying.
Actually, you do feel like you're dying, right? The first time around, you're not used to it. So no eating, no drinking, no talking. And I think the hardest part, and then you do a lot of, you do meditation and recitation, and you do a lot of prostration. Full length prostration, if you can manage it. Traditionally, you only need to do 3 sessions a day, but Lama Tsoba Rinpoche's tradition take so much time doing nothing, right? Do more, which is 4 sessions on the fasting day. Since you cannot eat, you cannot drink, it takes up a lot of time, not all the eating, and the talking, and you cannot talk, right? So you might as well just stay on the cushion and do more practice. So 4 sessions, and when you got through it, it really, because of the fasting, especially with the, it's actually mostly dehydration, you feel very physically very weak. Your joints start to ache, and then you have muscles that you didn't realize you possess, and they really hurt when you possess. When you do prostrations, right? And you really suffer, you know? And now you have to rely on inner resources. It doesn't help if the person next to you, there are lots of people around you, but they have no help at all. They are hindrance, actually. You need to avoid them, you need to look for space to prostrate, because they all start prostrating and you just try to get out. Yeah. Usually they choke space, man. No, where Singaporean gets you. This is my space, you go away. Choke space. Because at that point you have no energy to even fight with another people. You just want to get it over with. So everything becomes very slow. You prostrate slower and slower. With the prayers should go faster and faster so you can get out of it. And those weakened states, you find that actually you draw, you need to draw a lot within you. What you have within you. Not just physically, but also mentally and emotionally to get you through it. And this is true also with other difficult situations, illness, and so on. Then you can really appreciate those occasions, the importance to cultivate the inner strength, the strength of mind, and the ability to, what sort of resources I have within me to help me face with, very painful. It's actually physically unpleasant, right? And you can't run away with it because you are fasting, right? Unless you break the fast. Otherwise, you can't run away from those physical discomforts. And they really, pain and discomfort really drain your energy. It takes a lot of energy to do what you need to do in spite of those pain, in spite of those discomfort. It's very draining. And you have even less, energy and resources in the face of that. And you have to really draw on some inner qualities that you have found, or you realize you don't have any. Collapse there and wait for that. Sometimes you give a right. Ask for dispensation. Can I drink? Can I? I'm very, very, very hungry. Can I eat? Sometimes, depend on the retreat leader. Yeah. And usually I would say yes. Now what I'm going to do, right? If you collapse there, I have to call the ambulance. No. Say, okay, right, never mind. Just do it. Away from other people, so don't aggravate other people's situation. What are you drinking? Just yeah. So it is a fun. So I usually like to finish the retreat, the very last session. I like to do it very, very early in the night, actually, because I also cannot sleep. One of my problems with this when I do this retreat, because of dehydration, I can't sleep. So I just lie there and listen to people snoring. Some people, they react by, they feel very sleepy, right? They just sleep. But I can't sleep. I become brightly wide awake. You know? And that was great suffering. So I like, so usually we send it for the last session, very, very last session, 4 a.m. Good. Actually, we can do it at 3 a.m. We can also do it at 2 a.m. No problem, since I can't sleep, right? And, so usually, and there are different versions of this practice. And some people, you only break fast at the end of the session. Wow, that was really tough. Because already you're half day, right? You're dehydrated. I like the version where I break fast at the beginning. No need to eat. I only need to drink. I only need water, actually. And the first sip of water, I can tell you, wow. No, it's really wonderful. And suddenly, just that little bit of water entering, the energy starts to come back. You don't know where you are. Then the aches and pains start to disappear. Yeah. Usually we can't overdo it, but we're not very healthy from the health perspective. Because we kind of like drown in. We used to drink water, and then Milo, and then, 100 plants, and all sorts of things. We just dump all sorts of things inside to rehydrate the system. And then I can do the last session. Because if you ask me to lead, then I need to break fast before I can lead the last session. I don't have the energy to say anything. Right, anyway, so this 9-point meditation on death is to reflect and to get us to take death seriously. And to, while we are alive and well and healthy, to not just look after external conditions, also look after inner resources, to build our inner resources to help us at time of dying, but also at other difficult times. So when you have that inner resources, it really become very handy when we confront them with pain, with difficulty, and of course with a really tough situation of dying. And so that's the whole idea. Any questions about this? He never mentioned it. It's a mantra that taught to him by his teacher, Ling Rinpoche, the previous Ling Rinpoche. But he never, I think it's some secret practice. Yeah, he never mentioned what is the name of it. Any other? Yes. Say again. dying in your sleep a good death? Depends on where you're coming from. From a Buddhist perspective, no, it's not. Because you die in your sleep, you are not as aware of that process. And especially in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, the best way to die is to bring as much of your awareness with you as you enter into the final dying process. Because there are certain practices that we do, can do as they enter the final dissolution process. And there are practices actually that people do at the point of death, at the time of death. So from that perspective, dying in the sleep is not, because when you're asleep, you are not so conscious, right? And then the process happens. And so there are more, greater chance that you will go through the whole process, not so aware, not so alert. Right? From that perspective, it's not good. But for someone who, anyway, either way, never done any practice, right? So awake or sleep, make no difference. Then, of course, conventionally, a lot of people say it's not a bad way to die, because you don't have experience any fear, you don't experience any disturbance, and you just go peacefully. So, relatively speaking, I think, from the point of view of a practitioner or non-practitioner, you decide. Okay, so today I want to introduce another way of meditating on death awareness. I made up this meditation because I'm so bad with this 9-point meditation. I don't feel anything when I meditate on it. And I mentioned earlier on, am I so hot? Something is wrong with this aircon system. Maybe I'm having a reaction. Yeah. I'm not that old, okay? The whole idea of doing what we call analytical meditation, which we explore certain topic, we try to look at it from different points of view, which could involve thinking about it and drawing on our knowledge, understanding, also our life experiences, our memories. The whole point is to bring about a change of mind or a change of heart. We want to, previously I explained, we want to change our perspective so that we see things a bit differently and we think about it differently, we feel differently, and therefore we can behave differently, we can respond differently. We want to bring about some positive change. We don't want to, of course, if things are going well, there's no need to change. But quite often we have a lot of old conditioning, a lot of old habits that are not so helpful. In fact, sometimes they create a lot of problems for us, a lot of suffering for us. So that's why when we engage in analytical meditation, what we are trying to do is we are trying to bring about that change. And for that change to happen, we need to have some response from ourselves as we reflect or as we bring those ideas to mind. We want to bring forth some kind of response from ourselves. If we are non-responsive, then nothing changed, right? We just have all these words going through our head. Oh, point one is like this, point two, point three, point four, point nine, and okay, finish, done. Don't feel anything different, don't think any different, you basically have no reaction at all. Right? So that is not ideal. So we want something some response to come forth. Right? Usually we cannot predict what that response is, but having some response is better than having no response. Okay? And I find, personally, if you give me a list like this, I tend to be very logical. I tend to go, like, tick, 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 okay, finish. But then I don't feel anything. It hasn't really somehow integrate. It hasn't somehow bring about a change. So that's not helpful. So when I meditate on death, I try to find other ways to do it. And what you want to do actually is that change can be a change in perspective. So we take what our life experiences, things we have experienced so far, and we try to integrate that with these new ideas, this new framework, new way of thinking. We try to integrate them and so that they have some kind of interaction, and then something different comes up. And some may not be so different, but you may have experienced that. But at least some response, some feeling, or some new way of thinking. Oh, I never see it that way before. A change of mind, a change of heart. This one, the one. So I came up with this meditation. I tried to present a more tame version because it can be quite a little bit. I never know how people will react to it. I call it the world without me. Because when I'm dead, my physical presence will disappear from this world, right? I'm gone for good, forever. Yeah. So this is a meditation of, it's like the world will be empty of me. Right? And what we do in preparation for that is we need to go and say goodbye. So to the world, to the places, different places or locations that are of significance to us. Okay, so places like when I'm dead, my room will be empty. Right? I'm no longer physically there. My house or my home will be empty of me. It's an opportunity now to say goodbye to that place that I may have spent many days, weeks, years. And also there are other places that are of great significance to me. Right? Now these places, I emphasize places, not people, okay? People can be a bit tough. So this meditation, I just want us to, we don't want to have kind of some overwhelming kind of reaction. We just want to work with the idea of saying goodbye to the important places in our life. Places, locations, can be buildings, venues. Yeah. Those places may actually physically exist at this moment, or they only exist in your memory because time changed and they have already disappeared in the physical location. But nonetheless, they are places of our heart. They are important places in our life. And so in this meditation, we go to all those different places. Some people would like to do it chronologically. I tend to do it in all sorts of random ways. Whatever place that comes to mind, you know, places where we have significant life experiences. And you can go back to the place and say goodbye for one last time because I'm going to die. And I'm not going to revisit those places, not going to revisit them physically nor emotionally and mentally. I'm moving on in a sense. Yeah. So I'm going to say my final goodbye to those places. And usually I emphasize not to have people in those places, but usually because it is the people that make those places significant, those occasions significant. But I don't want the meditation to be too intense, too traumatic, you know, to traumatize you. So I say, no people. But then some people, I have taught this meditation before, they say, oh, it felt so unnatural. Then I say, okay, fine. You can have what we call telesaires, the extras, those people of no importance at all. They're just like background, you know, mingling. Like if you think of a special cafe, right, you can fill it up, populate it with unimportant extras. You don't even know who they are, but they just for atmosphere. Then you feel like, oh, it's a real place. You just go, but none of those people that are important to you, because just keep them for another occasion, okay? And you just go back to those places and you just think, oh, I have good times or bad times, you know, and important times, and now it's time to say goodbye. Right? Say goodbye, then you move on to the next place. And it's just to help you to integrate this whole idea that we are talking about death and your own life experiences, bad experiences that you have in the different places in life. And so it's a way to illustrate this idea of connecting your own actual memories and life experiences with the idea that we are meditating on, in this case, death, which really involves saying goodbye. A special kind of goodbye. This goodbye is forever. There's no coming back again because I'm going to die. And even if I'm reborn, you will be a different person, a different body, a different kind of makeup, constitution, in a different time also, a different place. Right? So things would have changed dramatically. So this is an occasion to say our final goodbye. Make sense? Right? Right? And then you just do it. You know? You don't have to, you're not writing some script for some Korean drama, you know, you try to, like, squeeze and make, oh,
I'm so sad.
But if you do feel sadness, that is fine, but you don't have to try to, don't make it so dramatic, you know, you try to, you know, the Korean drama, the, or whatever drama, Korean, they do it very well. They bring you up, they bring you down, and then, you know, then over a few episodes, usually 3 episodes, I think, and then they start another round again. No, like some roller coaster, literally, like some quite song. I mean, no, if life is a bit boring and stressful, then you just go on this artificial roller coaster. No, yeah, try not to do it because no need to make your meditation so intense unnecessary. But just take this opportunity to see how we can integrate our actual life experiences with the new idea we talk about. And see how you resonate with it. Whether anything comes forth. And be mindful and aware of it. And so that this is a way of integrating the topic with your own experiences and to see what kind of response comes forth from within yourself. It's a way of assimilating the topic. Sounds okay? Let's just do a meditation on this. This is hard work. I'm sweating. Meditating on death is no easy job. Physically tough. Okay. So please find a comfortable supportive posture for your body to meditate in. So whichever posture you adopt, try to allow your back, your spine to be upright in a natural way. So by then, you don't have to tense up or tighten your back muscles just to straighten your spine. But just find a position that allows the spine to extend upwards, to be as comfortable as possible, for your chest to feel open and you can breathe freely and easily. So good to rest your hands or arms in such a way to allow your shoulders to be relaxed and rest your hands on both knees or place them one on top of the other in your lap. Feel free to close your eyes completely during this meditation and you can always open your eyes during the meditation if you feel very sleepy, if you don't like the kind of feelings or images that are coming up in your meditation, you can always take a break. The easiest way is just open your eyes to reorientate yourself back to here and now in this room. So take a few moments to let your body settle into your posture. And I call this the first step of meditation, acquiring a seat, a supportive seat for your body and mind to meditate in. Really allow your body to feel that it is well supported. It's comfortable and safe in this posture so that your body can automatically begin the process of loosening up, unwinding, letting go of some unnecessary tension, tightening in the body. Good to relax your face if possible. So often we tense up our facial muscles, we tense up the muscles of our forehead, those in the jaw, those around the eyes. So if you do notice tension in the face, see if you can consciously try to relax your facial muscles. Just let in a feeling of softness into your face so that your whole face feels a lot more comfortable, more relaxed, more at ease. The second step of the meditation is good to take some time to help our body and mind transition into meditation. So for that, we can make use of the breath. We can place our attention on the breath sensations in the body and return our attention to it when we do get distracted. So see if you can just notice the sensations of the breath in your body. You may notice it around your nostrils, where you feel the air flow in and out of your body, Some around me notice the breath at the chest area, a sense of expansion and contraction. And others may notice the breath at the abdomen, a movement of rising and falling. So gently see if you can just return your attention so that you are aware of the breath, so that you are aware of your in-breath and your out-breath. It doesn't require much effort, so don't need to try too hard. Just become a bit more sensitive, a bit more aware of the breath flowing in and out, expanding, contracting, rising, falling within your body. And see if you can make use of your natural out-breath. Each time you breathe out, there's a sense of release as the muscles of your diaphragm and your chest relax, allowing the air to flow out. See if, as you breathe out naturally, allow that movement of release. So you can release as you breathe out the stale air in your lungs, and maybe also some of the tightness or tension in the body. Maybe those tensions can also flow away with the breath. So see if you can just gently come back to the breath as and when you notice that your attention is drawn away to other things, to sounds, to thoughts, to memories, to images in your mind that is not related to the meditation. This is quite normal, and all you need to do is just come back to the breath. So let's do this for a few minutes at the beginning of the meditation, coming back to the breath, especially as you breathe out, remind yourself to release. Coming back to your breath sensations within the body, breathing out, deepening the sense of release. The breath can be a support for you throughout the meditation. Whenever you find yourself getting a bit distracted, you can always come back to the breath. Maybe you feel confused, not sure what is happening, you can always come back to the breath. an in-between recollection of places of significance to you in this life. In between that, you can always rest your attention on the breath. And now to begin the third step of the meditation. Sometimes I call this deepening meditation. We're going to try to go deeper into this meditation related to death, cultivating awareness of death. And we do that by recollecting places of significance to you. Important places where you may have experienced heavy moments. Can also be difficult times, but you're most welcome to ignore that if you don't want to. Happy moments, important moments, passionate moments. Just recollect the place, allow the place to come to you from your memories. Look around the place. I advise you not to involve people of significance, loved ones in this meditation. Just stick to the places. You can recollect the sounds, the sights. You can, of course, populate it with people, extras that are not of significance to you. If you can soak up and recollect the atmosphere of place and reflect on the importance of this place to you in this life. And as you allow the place to come to life, you reactivate all memories of this life related to this place. And when you feel ready, see if you can say goodbye. Say your final goodbye to this place, because we are all going to die. And we are coming here to make peace with the place, to finish unfinished business, to say our goodbye. Do that for each place. Spend as little or as much time as you want with each place, and then move on to the next. And feel free to do it in your own way, at your own pace. Just see if you can come back, visit the places of significance to you in this life to say your goodbye. So coming back to the meditation, see if you can recollect and dwell on the places of importance to you. See if you can reactivate those memories, present memories if possible. The sights, the sounds, the feelings. Death is about goodbye. Many, many goodbyes. And it is of great fortune when we have the opportunity to actually say goodbye. So now we are doing a dress rehearsal in this meditation. We bring forth all memories of places and we practice saying goodbye. coming back to the meditation, do not think that goodbye is about cutting things off, severing the connection. That can never happen. Those places are places we store within our hearts and minds. They are our memories. They will always be with us, always connected with us, always related to us. Saying goodbye is a way of acknowledging their importance, their places in your heart. To give them the deal, the importance, acknowledge it in the light of death. So, coming back to the meditation, if you do find yourself distracted elsewhere, try to come back, reconnect with the different places of significance in your life. And as you take a tour around the places, as you reconnect the feelings, the experiences associated with that place, take this opportunity to say goodbye. Saying goodbye is not the end of that relationship or that connection, but it's an acknowledgement of that connection. And it belongs to the past so that you can move on and begin something new, something different. And then finally, a few last few moments, consolidate your experiences during this meditation, the feelings, the thoughts, your reactions. And then dedicate may whatever good or positive that come out of this meditation and a positive momentum may stay with you, may linger on in body and mind, and may it contribute towards the fulfillment of your aspirations for yourself. Okay, so death in Buddhism is not it's like a natural process. It's as natural as going to sleep or visiting a toilet, eating or drinking. It's that a natural part of life. Life begins with birth or conception and then birth and ends with death. It's as natural as anything else. In fact, to say that there is no death becomes very unnatural. Right? So the whole idea of what we have covered so far, meditating on death, cultivating an awareness of death, is not about becoming paranoid about death. So, oh, I'm going to die. People ask you, no, I cannot. I might be killed on the road. People can get very terrified of death, but become paranoid of death is everywhere. In a way it's true, but that's not the reaction that we are trying to cultivate. In fact, we are trying to normalize death so that we don't see it as something so frightening and so untouchable and must not have any reminder about it. It's actually a very natural part of it. And the funny thing about in Buddhism, and in general, also in Tibetan Buddhism, death is like nothing. It's no big deal. And there are people who actually feel very happy to die. Not that they're tired of living, but they welcome death. It's like the next adventure. It really is. In fact, the Dalai Lama said that there are people who, they do certain practices in Tibetan Buddhist tradition especially, where the only time you can practice it is when you're dying, and at the time of death. So it's kind of like you prepare, and the actual moment of death, oh, there's the big moment, the moment of truth. There's the moment you actually put a lifetime of practice into actual operation, actual function. And so the death process becomes like the next adventure into the unknown and beyond. Like Star Trek, like that. No. Instead of flying out into the space, you go deep into your own consciousness. So it's like, oh, eagerly away. I wouldn't say that, but it's all about the wonderful thing. It's not a sad thing, not an unhappy thing, but it's just a very natural, wonderful opportunity, another opportunity. Yeah, and next week we'll talk about preparing for death, preparing for death, and the actual dying process as presented in Tibetan Buddhism. And then maybe you can appreciate why, for some people, especially practitioners, death is not a sad time. It's actually can be a very joyous time, a time where you put a lifetime of practice into action and see how well you have been doing, or how badly you have been doing. I cannot remember a thing. I can't die. Wait, I'm not ready yet. I used to joke, me and my, when I was in Sydney, usually another fellow teacher, we take turns to teach these courses. We do all these death courses a lot, right? How you should die, prepare, and la-di-da-la-di-da. Then we privately we always joke. I wonder how we would do when it's our turn to die, right? We may not behave so properly, no, you remember you say, we used to joke, you know, we're holding on to the bitch and say, no, I don't want this part. We're a bit malu, right? A bit embarrassing. Yeah, but no. What you do, we just have to be practice harder, be more prepared, yeah. Okay, any question or any comments about that meditation? I hope you don't have a bad reaction, you know. The message. No reaction is okay, but bad reaction, then maybe, you know, we need to do some debrief about it. Yes? Is it good to quietly go out on your own or with all those people around you? If they're not. Actually, in Tibetan Buddhism, the usual advice for the actual death is that people can be around you, but they really shouldn't be crying, or they shouldn't do anything that will disturb your mind. You know, definitely not do what Cantonese, you know, those sort of process. Oh, don't die, please don't die. I say it's very unfair to the dying person, right? They should answer, I also don't want to die. But I can't help it. Why are you asking me to do the impossible? Right? So the whole idea is you mustn't disturb the person's mind. No. I mean, they are going through a difficult, in a way, difficult time, right? So if you can help them, be supportive, and different people do things. Some people prefer to go on their own, and some people prefer to go surrounded by others. You might have heard of stories of people, they sort of hang on until that particular person arrives to see them for the last time, and then they expire. Then there are also stories where they hang on until everybody go off, you know, Singapore hospital, I go to the kopitiam. They all go off, and in their absence, they expire, they die. So I think there's no absolute answer. But the most important thing is, if there are people around you, then they ought not to do anything that disturbs your mind. Like say, have you written your will? What do you do? You know what I mean? Things that stirs up unnecessary emotions and concerns and worries, they don't need that, especially at the moment of dying. No. And if you can try to help them to have a peaceful mind, very positive mind, feel very settled and very sort of like, no, without worries, without any more concern, lingering concern, then that is the best gift you can give to a dying person. Yeah. Any other question? Okay. Yes. Okay. In general, I would advise you to say, I want to come back to those places. First of all, those places are most probably physically no longer exist. To have changed. And another reason why I wouldn't advise in general is because that would be maybe a form of attachment, you know, that you try to hold on to those places. I also don't know, especially if people are living there, you'll be haunting those places if you were to come back, right? Don't be so, just go, alright? Just go. Don't come back, okay? But if it is holy places like pilgrimage, or if you are reflecting on maybe the images of one spiritual teacher comes to mind, then that might be not so much coming back to the places, but you can make prayers of aspiration, you know, to be able to reconnect with the Dharma, with the teacher. That would be something auspicious. But don't come and come back to those places, because in a way, as we die, those places, even holy places, are changing, right? Like Kopan Monastery in Nepal, you know, every few years, building projects, something old, you know, something is different already, right? So the importance is actually not the place. The important is the connection with what is there. The important thing, like the Dharma, one's spiritual teachers, or certain qualities. Yeah. Okay, alright, anyway, that's enough of that for this week. So, thank you very much for your attention, and hope to see you next week. Yeah, have a good week.